you know, you can ask the question, if you don't know what we're doing down here, if you've never done it, why are you in charge? And you know,
which seems like a valid question, right?
Yeah, I didn't encourage that question, but it was absolutely. And you have to ask it yourself. And the first response is to fake your way through it. The first response is to sort of puff up, hide behind your stars or whatever badges you have of your importance, and fake it. But that's a bad way to do business, because over time, people figure it out, plus you're just not very helpful. And so I came to the conclusion that it was going to be a lot better just to be honest.
Thanks for pressing play. Legends and Losers is sponsored by Oracle NetSuite. Learn how to turbocharge the growth of your business at netsuite.com/legends. Today, a very special episode with four-star general Stanley McChrystal. He has a new book out called Leaders, Myth and Reality. And this is his second time on Legends and Losers. And many people would pay many thousands of dollars just for the chance to sit down for a coffee or a beer with this man. And I couldn't be more happy to share this conversation with you. We have a wide-ranging discussion. We talk about things like what 9/11 was like for him. We dig into the myths around leadership and the dichotomies of leadership. We talk about how to come back from a very public downfall, why people should serve their country, and what it's like to transition from a military career to becoming an entrepreneur, and also why four-star General Stanley McChrystal loves being a grandfather.
Hello, my legendary friends. This is Legends and Losers, the show for people who like to eavesdrop on killer dialogues, brilliant rants, and crazy diversions, straight up with a business twist. Hosted by Christopher Lockhead, former three-time CMO and co-author of Play Bigger, who has one of the most strategic minds in marketing, but could also hide his own Easter eggs. And now, strap yourselves in. It's time for Legends and Losers.
All right, all right, all right. Hey-ho, let's go. Hello, my legendary friends. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode of Legends and Losers. I'm really glad you're here. I hope you're doing great. If you're a longtime listener, thank you from the bottom of my whiskey-stained heart. It means the world to me that you're here. And if you're new to Legends and Losers, I want to let you know we are one of the few free-range, long-form dialogue podcasts. We try to capture real conversations, not edited, overproduced interviews with amazing people about how to design a legendary business and a legendary life, all while dealing with the inevitable losses that we all face along the way. Today, we have an incredibly special guest, an American treasure, retired four-star general Stanley McChrystal. His last role in the U.S. military was as commander leading the Allied forces in Afghanistan. He's widely praised for creating a revolution, a whole new paradigm in warfare that fuses intelligence and operations in a whole new way. Today, he's an entrepreneur. He's a teacher and educator, and he's a multi-time best-selling author. You can learn more about him. You can check out information on his new book, et cetera, at legendsandlosers.com. And here he is for the second time, General Stanley McChrystal. Last time we were together, I remember very much talking about your granddaughters. So I'm curious to ask you, if I could, how's that going?
That is going amazingly. As you'll remember, they live next door to me. And so the oldest one, Emmy Lou, is about 4 years and 3 months now. And she's this little princess, long blonde hair, you know, big brown eyes, and sort of a diva in waiting. And then her little sister is 20 months. And her little sister is her little sister is Elsie. And she's a little bit like an NFL linebacker. And, you know, if you get between Elsie and what she wants, you're going down.
Let me see if I have this right. You have a diva and a linebacker going.
Exactly.
Well, those sound like the perfect granddaughters for you.
They are perfect for me. And I just find them really funny. And they treat me like a piece of furniture.
How do you mean?
Well, you know, I don't think they pay me a whole lot of mind in terms of, you know, honored grandfather, which was the position that I nominated myself for. Instead, they climb on me. They laugh at me. It's good.
No one told them that you're this decorated American hero.
They didn't get the memo.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you're still having a lot of fun with them, Stan.
It's more fun than ever. Every day is that way. And because we live so close to them, we're able to interact so much. It's just, we're part of their lives in a way we couldn't be if we were anywhere else.
Yeah. And I can hear it in your voice. It sounds like you enjoy babysitting duty.
We do. Every weekend, we keep them at least one night. And
oh, wow.
And of course, they love it because the rules are a bit looser at our house.
You mean grandma and grandpa let them do things that maybe mom and dad don't?
Absolutely.
Spoil them and hand them back, right?
And feed them with sugar.
Oh, I love it. That's so fantastic. Well, you sound fantastic. You look great. How have you been?
Life has been perfect, Chris. Everything is just sort of clicking. I turned 64 3 weeks ago. So, I should be waning, but things feel great. Still able to do all the working out.
Do people keep quoting Paul McCartney to you? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Exactly. And our business is growing dramatically. We just started the new Yale semester. What we do for the Yale course is we bring our students down to Alexandria, Virginia for the first weekend, and we teach the first two seminars here. And that way we create a special experience for this 21 young people, of course. And of course that's very, and then we had a reunion. We've been teaching 8 years now. We had a reunion for everyone who's an alumni of the course. And we've got about 60 of them to show up. So it was a pretty special gathering.
And what are the kinds of things you do with them?
In the class, what we do is we start with a simulation of communication and whatnot. And that worked really well. And then we look at some philosophical readings because we try to start the semester. It's a journey studying leadership, but part of what they're studying is themselves. And what we're trying to do is convince them that they've got to decide an awful lot about what their values are, what their ethics are, what their strengths are. Because you can't be somebody else. You can't pick another leader, emulate them, and be that. You got to be yourself. And so we spent a lot of time on that, some Aristotle readings and some other things. And now, after this first weekend, they'll begin this journey over. It's actually for the year now. We've expanded the course. And hopefully next spring, they will be more thoughtful, more ready to be leaders, still, on a lifelong journey.
Aren't we all?
You got it. Exactly.
Now, I also have to ask you, I saw the post you wrote for, I think it was Fortune, on Senator McCain.
Absolutely.
I thought it was fascinating, especially as you, if I remember the article or the post properly, you sort of describe your first meeting or a meeting with him where you had some maybe trepidation about what was going to happen. So I'd just be curious, can you bring your relationship with Senator McCain to life for me?
Absolutely. I had known Senator McCain for some years. It's not close, but when I was in Iraq, he would come visit. And so there was a relationship where he knew me and I knew him and we respected each other. When I became the commanding general in Afghanistan in the summer of 2009, I had to meet with him before my confirmation, and that was fine. But he's a very direct guy. I mean, when he thinks something, he just sort of fires it out. And so he came to Afghanistan, and I had been there for maybe 3 weeks or a month. And
Stan, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Is it possible for you to turn your notifications off?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know how to do that. all right.
I'm sorry. Keep going.
Yeah. I don't know how to do it on my computer. So, but anyway.
All right. Well, then no worries.
Yeah. So he was coming over and we were in the midst of this strategic review. And that was something that the Secretary of Defense had directed me to do, to review the entire mission. As you know, there was a great deal of uncertainty in President Obama's still new administration about where Afghanistan should go. And so I'm in the 60-day review, which was going to be politically contentious, no matter what findings we came to. Now, at that point in it, I was about a month in, and so I'd already come to the realization we were going to need to ask for more forces, and we were going to need to change the basic strategy in Afghanistan, have any chance of succeeding. But I wasn't prepared to release that to anybody, because I want to go through my boss, the Secretary of Defense, before doing that. And so Senator McCain comes over with Senator Graham and Senator Lieberman, and they're sort of the triumvirate, and they want a small meeting. And so I get in there with them, and Senator McCain basically called me out. He goes, "Listen, are you going to ask for more troops?" And I told him, "Well, I'm not through with the assessment yet. And I will let you know." And he then launched at me and said, "You won't." And he basically didn't say it exactly this way: "You don't have the guts to tell the president what you really need." And of course, as soon as I heard that, you know, I bowed up and called him out. And so there was this moment, you know, sort of chest to chest, where, you know, it was an inappropriate relationship between a senator and a general. Now, it was diffused very quickly. And I actually think that he had done what he wanted to do. He wanted to put me on notice that I needed to show courage. And I don't really think he doubted my courage. I think he was trying to send me a message. Hey, this is going to be a moment when you give your findings to the president where you're going to have to truly speak your mind. And after that, we had a great relationship. We continued a good relationship, but it became much closer when I left the service, because I started working on national service for young people, and he's a very strong supporter. So we started partnering on how could we make civilian national service an opportunity for every young American.
Yeah.
And that gave us a reason to meet regularly.
I've seen as well, you've written about this, that you think that, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that every young person should do a year of national service. Am I remembering this right?
You're exactly right, Chris. I think every young person, you know, not every young person can or should go in the military, but every young person should give a year to their country. And what I really mean by that is give a year to other Americans.
Yeah.
And that experience of working with people you don't know, doing something maybe you're not familiar with, I think will strengthen the bond of citizenship through a lifetime.
It's interesting. A while back, we had author Sebastian Younger on the podcast. Do you know him at all?
I do.
Yeah.
I'm a big admirer.
Yeah. And he says the same thing. He said this thing that sort of stopped me dead in my tracks, which is America is a country that asks nothing of you. Like, even if you don't pay your taxes, we'll just put you in jail and feed you. Like, we ask nothing of you. And he had a similar point of view. And I had never quite thought about it that way. And I contrast it with, for years, I worked with many Israelis and spent a lot of time in Israel. And obviously, it's a much smaller country. But there is a sense of connectedness in Israel that is very prevalent, very palpable, that I noticed. And it seems to come from a shared military service, a shared service to the country.
I think that's absolutely true, and I think it's natural. When you invest in something, when you are forced to invest in something, your time or your money or whatever, you have a different sense of your own legitimacy as a citizen or a stockholder in that. What we found is if people do service, they vote at three times the rate of people who don't do service. Think of that, because I think you feel, hey, I just spent a year working for this country. I'm going to vote on which direction we're going.
Yeah.
And it's like I remember I had a very painful season in high school basketball when I sat the bench literally the whole year. I got in one game. I took one shot. I made it. I left with the highest shooting percentage probably in the league, but the least playing time. But what really struck me is at the end of the year, I didn't feel like a legitimate member of the team. When we won, I wasn't particularly overjoyed. And when we lost, I wasn't as downcast as I wanted to be, because I didn't feel like I was a fully invested member. And I think if we let members of our society not feel like fully invested, they're not going to do the kinds of things I think we want citizens to do.
Yeah. Yeah. It is interesting that it feels sometimes that like we live in a world where we don't acknowledge our connectedness. And we live in a political environment, and, you know, I don't necessarily want to have a big political conversation, but where the ability to, if you could call it, disagree agreeably seems to have, for the most part, gone away. The understanding that we actually need people on either sides of the aisle to debate and to argue to get us to a better outcome. We, you know, nobody wants a country run by all Republicans. Nobody wants a country run by all Democrats. We need that thoughtful, dynamic tension. It's healthy. And yet we behave in a very different way. We behave like we're not on the same team, is I guess what I'm trying to say.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I mean, if you think of the analogy, if we were all in a lifeboat and we were fighting and rocking the lifeboat, at some point the lifeboat could sink and then everybody's got a problem. And I think that we have to think that way. I mean, countless studies tell you that diversity of thought and diversity of background makes a better team. You know, Karl Marx told us that the dialectic, you know, of opposing ideas brings forth a stronger central idea, whatever place we want to get to. And the idea that that's our responsibility to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, last time we were together, I wanted to speak with you about 9/11 and we got excited about other things. And so it just didn't happen. So I wanted to maybe go there if I could. I've heard you talk a little bit about what you were doing on 9/11. So I wouldn't mind if you could maybe share some of that with me. And then maybe we could talk about sort of how the events of 9/11 shaped you personally going, you know, beyond that date.
No, absolutely. And I'll go a little bit before 9/11 because I'd already spent a good part of my life in counterterrorism. And so I was probably more aware than the average person about the rising terrorist threat to the United States and to our allies. And I had actually spent June of 2001 in Kuwait, and I was assigned there for a month-long period. It was a program that the Army used to get young brigadier generals very, very aware of what was happening in the Gulf region, because that was always a likelihood of conflict. So I spent the month there, and during that month, there was this incredibly high level of alert because intelligence told us that Osama bin Laden was planning some kind of operations, didn't know. People assumed it would be against forces in Kuwait or Saudi Arabia. So I was very attuned to that. Actually, on September 11th, I'd come back to the United States and I was in my job as a Corps Chief of Staff, a Brigadier General, assisting a three-star Corps commander command a 50,000-person Army Corps. Several divisions. And that day it was a very warm, you know, bright morning at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And we went out to do a practice parachute jump in a new variant of the C-130 airplane, which was a typical airplane used to drop paratroopers. So we were out there, usually you jump at night with a lot of equipment because this was to test this new plane. I went out with my Corps commander boss and a few other people to do a jump, and it was almost like a holiday thing because it's just not as hard as the average one. So we put our equipment on and we do our thing, and then we take off. And when we took off, the United States was at peace. And you fly a flight route to get to the drop zone. And during that flight route, about 10 minutes before you fly over the drop zone, they open the parachute door. So now the wind is rushing in and you're in your parachute, and you're hooked up to a static line, prepared to jump. And we went through all of that. And we were at that point, probably, I don't know, 5 or 6 minutes from actually dropping. And the Air Force crewman, the loadmaster who works up near the parachute door in the back of the plane with you, he came up to my boss and said, "Sir, a plane just hit the World Trade Towers." And he just informing him, and my boss turned to me and said, "Wow, that's a, you know, kind of a freakish accident."
And were you, and, I hate to interrupt you, Stan, but were you thinking it was a freak accident, or is there any part of you that was thinking this was nefarious?
No, I was thinking freak accident. I was thinking of the aircraft that had hit the Empire State Building, you know, 40, 50 years before.
Maybe like a biplane or something, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because we didn't get anything more than a plane hit the World Trade Towers. And so we said, well, that's sad. We jumped. And when I jumped, I landed on the drop zone. I was getting out of my parachute, and a sergeant who worked for me came up to me and he said, sir, have you heard? I said, yeah, I heard. He said, well, a second plane hit the second World Trade Tower. And a bomb went off at the Pentagon, because that's the reporting he had at that point. And then he looked at me and he said, sir, I think everything's changed. And at that point, it was clear to me that's exactly correct. And so I got with the young sergeant. We got in our military vehicle and we drove back to our headquarters to see what was going on and how that would impact us. I got back before the towers had actually fallen. So I got back into the office, the television's on, and you see the flames and smoke coming out of the towers. Nobody's quite sure at that point how many people are in the towers and so what the danger is. And then suddenly one of the towers fell. Remember, they imploded down. And we sat there really mesmerized by the TV, realizing the magnitude of this.
Yeah.
The number of people that were likely there and the impact on the country. And so
you just watched it on TV like the rest of us.
Exactly.
Yeah. And right. What was going on in your head about how America had changed, you know, once you saw the second plane and then of course the tower start to come down?
Well, exactly. The first thing is, you know, at that point, it's a terrorist attack. I assumed that it was Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda. We didn't have hard intel at that point. But the other thing we assumed was there would likely be other terrorist attacks in the United States.
Yeah.
And so because we had the installation, we were on Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and then responsible for a number of other installations, immediately we start the coordination to close the post, to provide security. And of course, for about the first 48 to 72 hours, that produced a tremendous amount of chaos, because we had existing plans to close the post, but they really hadn't been well thought through, because the post said, we will close the post for security, we'll check everybody. But so many people have to come on post in the day, they found that took hours and hours and hours, and therefore you couldn't.
So just to lock down the base. Wow.
And then we said, okay, what we'll do for these first few days is we'll prioritize who comes on base. It's like we will bring nurses and doctors for the hospital because they need to be on base, but we won't bring in child care providers for the child care centers because they're
so
not
just
as important.
Minimize who's coming on the base.
Yeah, and of course we got it wrong, because if you don't have child care available, then the nurses and doctors can't. I mean, so we had all these things that were just practical things about changing the way we did security. And it took us actually, I would say, several months before that became regular enough to be easy. But then we started talking about what are the things we might have to do internationally. And within the coming days, there started to be requirements to posture forces to move.
Yeah. Wow. It's amazing that it took so long for you to feel like the bases themselves were secure.
Yeah. I mean, that although you think of a military base as secure, most were traditionally open.
Right.
And Fort Bragg had multiple highways that crossed it, U.S. highways and state highways. So you're talking about closing them. There's all these people who would traverse the base to get to the other side and do what they did. So we had to change a lot of the dynamics of life, which are still changed, probably permanently now.
And then how did you find out that, or when did it occur to you, depending on how it played out, that you were actually going to play a very significant role in defending the United States overseas in both Iraq and Afghanistan post 9/11? When did you know, you had your share of the burden to go prosecute?
Yeah. I mean, to be very honest, at the very beginning, you don't have an idea, but everybody wants to do their part. Everybody in uniform feels this urge, not because they want to fight in war, but they think it's irresponsibility. And to not go felt uncomfortable. And so in the fall,
I hate to interrupt you, but Yeah. Isn't there part of you that is angry, that wants to go kick somebody's ass, that wants to make somebody pay, that, or is, am I just immature in my emotions?
No, there's absolutely a part of you that wants to do that. And of course, that's not always the best part of you, because it's not the most rational part of you. You do want to go protect America and all, but you've got to watch the idea that I'm going to go punish people because they're bad, because the reality is their perspective is theirs and it might be just as valid as mine. But it's
and you were able to keep that level head even after watching 3,000 Americans die in such a horrible way.
Well, it goes up and down. You'll watch it certain times and you'll feel it, but then you'll get away. You'll think more rationally. You'll talk about things, and you have to watch letting, you know, emotion can't drive the use of military force, because if it does, you're going to do irrational things.
Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating. Now, if I could just switch a little bit, I've heard you talk about this idea of being reverse mentored. It is a phrase that I've heard you use. And I got to believe there are a lot of people in the world who would love to be mentored by you. And it would be easy, I think, for if I try to put myself in your position to feel like, you know, you're always Yoda and whoever you're with is always Luke Skywalker type of thing. But I've heard you talk about the power of being reverse mentored by younger people, by other people, et cetera. Would you mind expanding upon that for me?
Sure, I would, because it's more important than ever. I sometimes use the description. My grandfather was a soldier, and he entered the U.S. Army during World War I. And he stayed in the Army through World War II, and actually the beginning of the Korean War. And during that period, although military operations changed, they didn't change that much. And what that meant was the things he learned as a young officer, the equipment he used, was not hugely different from that which he did when he was a regimental commander in charge of many more troops. So his experience arguably was relevant enough where you could say he's the most experienced, knowledgeable guy in his unit because he's the oldest person. So people should listen to him. My career was very different. When I started, the equipment, the tactics we used and whatnot were one thing. And by the time I was leading at a senior level, they changed so much that my experience to what the young, smaller unit leaders were doing was not very relevant. There's still a personal part to it. There are some things that enduring things that don't change. So suddenly, you know, you can ask the question, if you don't know what we're doing down here, if you've never done it, why are you in charge? And you know,
which seems like a valid question, right?
Yeah, I didn't encourage that question, but it was absolutely. And you have to ask it yourself. And the first response is to fake your way through it. The first response is to sort of puff up, hide behind your stars or whatever badges you have of your importance, and fake it. But that's a bad way to do business, because over time, people figure it out, plus you're just not very helpful. And so I came to the conclusion that it was going to be a lot better just to be honest. And so honest with myself, honest with them, and say, listen, I don't know how this works down here. I want you to teach me what works, and I will provide those inputs which my age and experience, you know, might be able to do a value. You worry that it's going to undercut your legitimacy as a leader, but what I found is admitting you don't know, listening and letting people younger than you teach you is a pretty good sign of respect, and they don't hold you in less regard because of that. I think they at least in my experience, they give you more credit for that because you're willing to say, hey, show me what we're doing.
Right. So it's easy for some leaders to fall into this trap that says, hey, as the leader, I'm supposed to know everything. You know, if I'm the head of engineering, I have to be an engineer and have to be able to get in there and do that. Or if I'm the head of marketing, head of sales, or CEO, or whatever it is, right? And so if the headset for success is not, I need to know everything, you know, in your new book, you've got this word myth in the title, right? Then what is the headset I as a leader should have, given I'm leading an organization where there's no way I could know the specifics of all of the important details that need to happen?
Yeah, it's a key point, because we have this myth that the leader is all knowing, all powerful, all talented, all these things. And a lot of us fall prey to that. So when people come to us and ask us questions, whether it's stockholders or different things, you think you need the answer. I had a peer of mine who was an operations officer in a battalion. And I remember I was there. His boss came down and said, "Mark, what's A company doing right now?" And he goes, "Sir, I don't know." And the battalion commander goes, "Well, you're the operations officer. You should know that." And he goes, "Sir, do you want me to know that? If you want me to know that, I can know that, but I won't be working on what we're doing next month and 6 months from now. And I think that's my job."
Yeah.
And of course, the battalion commander sort of, you know, slunk away because he was clearly, the guy made a great point. I think leaders have got to decide what they do for the organization, what their real responsibility is. It's to provide a direction. It's to create an environment. It's to develop leaders. And many things, most things of the here and now have to be done by the people who are in slots designed and they are best prepared for that. And it takes a little bit of shaping of your ego for most leaders to step away from the myth that the leader is the strongest, most powerful, you know, that sort of thing, into the fact that the leader isn't the ecosystem. The leader is part of the process. And the core of the book really gets around saying, leadership is not about the leader. Leadership is something that's produced between leaders, followers, and all the contextual factors of a situation. And so the leader is part of the equation, but not necessarily dominant.
And is there, because there's a dichotomy that I've noticed in my life. On one hand, of course, as a leader, you have to have a high level of competence. You have to be able to communicate effectively. You have to be able to obviously make decisions. You know, there's a lot of things as a leader that we have to be able to do. At the same time, we all have weaknesses. And so, for example, I'm dyslexic. And so math was over for me in grade three. Well, you know, when you're an officer or director of a publicly traded company on NASDAQ and you can't read a spreadsheet, you know, that's an interesting situation to be in, right? And so my whole career, Stan, you know, when somebody came to me with financial data, I had to get myself educated, which I did. But I still, if you sent me a spreadsheet right now, I can't really read it. I have to sit down with you or somebody and help them walk me through it, unless it's very, very basic. And so, and having, you know, having a, let me call it a difference like that can be seen as a weakness. I actually think it's an advantage, but some can see it as a weakness. Anyway, long story longer, I had to get myself comfortable with saying, hey, somebody needs to come and help sit down with me and walk me through the spreadsheet because I can't read it without some help. But yet it seems like a dichotomy that when we do that, it's weakness. But I found when you do that, it actually changes things pretty dramatically with how people see you.
I think you're exactly right. And it's self-awareness. It's self-awareness that you admit and you're willing to admit to others. I think it almost always makes a leader more legitimate.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, Now, I we made up this word around here we call losery to make sort of failure and loss sound more fun than it is. And of course, nobody achieves the kinds of things that you've achieved without some losery along the way. I was reading this article about you in the Washington Post, talking about what happened post the Rolling Stone article. And if you don't want to talk about this, by all means, kick me under the table. But you said something I found so fascinating in that Post article. You said, quote, "You're going to find out who your friends are after an event like that happens." Would you mind sort of expanding upon what you mean by that?
Yeah, I'd like to do that and also hit another point as well. But you're right. Everybody is going to fail at something. You're going to fail at a marriage, or you're going to fail at raising a kid, or you're going to fail at a business, or you're going to fail at... Most will not fail as publicly as I did. Most will not see their name on the ticker of the news every 2 minutes for several days. And you will feel, regardless, you will feel like you failed, and therefore you are a failure. And what I found is one of the things you have to do is look to your friends that and the people you know, how they respond to you. I remember, you know, after the Rolling Stone article and I left the service, I'd walk through an airport and I'd see people look over, see me, and then they'd turn and they whispered each other. And I assumed that they were talking something bad about me. You know, there's that loser going by. Now, they probably weren't, but in my mind, that's what was happening in every case. Everyone who talked to me was gracious, but you know, again, my mind is building this up. And so I wasn't sure where I stood with my friends, so I didn't reach out to my friends. In fact, I was not even going to do a retirement ceremony, which is traditional parade they do to finish a soldier's service. I wasn't going to do one because I said it's not appropriate. In reality, I didn't want to do one because I thought, you know, nobody would show up and that would be another humiliation. Wow. But a friend of mine convinced me, no, there are people who care about you, and that is an opportunity for them to signal that. So we did it. And I had this tremendous group of people that showed up very publicly that day to some I hadn't seen for 30 and 40 years, classmates from West Point I hadn't seen, who flew in just to signal their support for me. Now, they weren't judging what I'd done as good or bad. They weren't saying, you know, they were just saying, we support you, failure and all. That was extraordinarily powerful to me because it sent a message that there are bonds that are just more important than what happens that moment. And to be honest, it made me more sensitive to how I react to other people for other people when they're in their moment and whatever that moment might look like.
Do you think you are, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but do you think you are less judgmental than maybe you were before?
Yeah, I know I am. I'm less judgmental about people who make mistakes. I still, you know, like all of us, I can get frustrated at people who do things that I think are wrong and they do it knowingly wrong, dishonest or whatever. But even that, people can make really bad decisions and they don't have to be really bad people. Because I've known really good people who've made really bad decisions at some point in life. And I've had to deal with a number of my friends and peers who've had something like that. And it's kind of funny because within the Army, I've sort of been identified as the guy to go to if you have a tragic ending. You know, they say, go see my Christian.
Is that the niche that you're now known for?
Yeah, I didn't really volunteer for that one. But, you know, they said, look, he had this big hiccup and he's back on his feet and he's okay. And so I become like an informal counselor and people come to me when they've had some kind of stumble.
The irony, and look, I'm biased because I have genuine affection for you and I deeply respect the many, many decades of service you have given to the U.S. and frankly to the world. But so bias declared, I look at it now and go, was it really that bad? I mean, even at the time, I thought, you know, every once in a while, everybody bitches on their boss. You know, maybe you shouldn't have. I don't know what. You know, but like, it wasn't like you did. I didn't look at it and go, oh, well, that was a horrible thing. Like, let me say it this way. I've done way worse, way bigger things that were way more fireable offenses that I didn't get fired for.
You know, here's the way I think about it, Chris, because you can spend the rest of your life trying to re-litigate what happens to you. And over time, you will convince yourself you were entirely right and you were wrong.
Yeah.
I think it's human nature. But here's where I come down. I don't think there was any malice or disloyalty on the part of my team. But at the end of the day, we put a problem on the president's desk, which was an inflammatory article from the Rolling Stone magazine. Whether we did it intentionally or not, it ended on his desk, and that's my responsibility not to do that.
Yeah.
And so did I fail? There's no other way to say than yes, I did, because if I hadn't failed, there wouldn't have been an article on his desk.
Yeah. And I've had this aha. I didn't think this early in my business life, but part of my job and my business relationships today in my own mind, you know, particularly as I, you know, the last 12 years or so, I've been really an advisor and an investor and this kind of stuff, as opposed to an executive or an entrepreneur. And particularly in that role, it's become clearer to me. My job number one when I'm working with a CEO is to never be her problem.
Yeah.
Right? Like my job is to help make problems go away, not create them. And if I'm going to do something that potentially is going to be, problematic, like, you know, in many cases I get brought in to help push the company, as I know you do. And so we're going to ruffle feathers, piss people off. I swear like a pirate, all these things. Right. But before we're going to do anything, you know, sort of, let me call it thoughtfully offensive to push or nudge the company, I need to make sure I'm completely in alignment with the CEO and kind of the core team to say, okay, now look, I'm going to go get after this one. And I also find myself, I had this recently with a company I'm working with, where I said to the CEO, given where we are in our initiative and this and that and the other, for the time being, between now and this particular event that's going to happen shortly in the future, I'm going to stand back and be more passive. If people ask for help, of course, I'll be there. But, and so this notion of when you throttle up and when you throttle down and kind of being coordinated about those things, I have found as now a 50-year-old man, I'm a lot more thoughtful about that as opposed to just rattling around inside the building however I want. How do you think about that now?
Yeah, you know, it's so easy to make it about you, even when you think you're not doing that. You've been so successful, you can be brought into a company and there's a possibility in your mind, you say, I am going to save this company, me. And they are going to carry me out on their shoulders when I've done that. And then they will, you know, the mere mortals will continue on. And it's not about you. I started this company, McChrystal Group, and we've grown to almost 100 people. And I'm not running it now. My partner, Chris Fussell, is the president. And he is the president. And I have learned that in most meetings, I should say nothing. I still have a role, I still have functions that I perform. But the reality is, it's not about me whether my name's on the door or not. It's about this team because they're the ones who are going to succeed or fail. I like being part of it.
Are you sure you can trust that former Navy SEAL?
I trusted him with my life, so it seems like a small thing to trust him with the business.
I mean, of course, I don't know him anywhere near how you do, but getting to know him just a little bit, he seems like an incredibly affable, honorable guy.
He's so thoughtful. Even when he was an O3 or a Navy lieutenant, when I first met him, he was more mature and more thoughtful than I have ever been. And that was, 15 years ago. And he just keeps getting more so. So I've learned, I play the part of the elder statesman. And, people say, if you don't have anything smart to say, don't say anything. So I don't say too much.
Now, there are a couple of things I still want to touch on in the book, but because we're on this entrepreneur topic, I find it so fascinating as a guy who started as an entrepreneur, with a paper route when I was a kid, and then I started my first real company at 18, that you have had this extraordinary public service career, if I could call it that, for many decades, and you achieved, you tell me, pretty much the highest level that is possible in that world. And you have this second phase of your life where you're an entrepreneur, you're an author, you're a teacher, you're a trainer, you're a coach, you're a lot of these things. And some of them you were before, but business is different than the military, is it not? Tell me a little about this switch from sort of four-star general to entrepreneur, and now to entrepreneur who's letting go of the reins and letting Fussell run the ship.
Yeah, first thing I have to say that I've been incredibly lucky because when I left the service, there was that moment when you think, all is lost and, I'll never be happy again. And I have just had this run of good fortune to work with good people and do things like that. So part of it is just luck. But what I found is being an entrepreneur, starting a company is a little bit frightening. And as you would know, you had the courage to do it. You were younger than I have. But it's exciting and you get to mold a team and everything that's wrong in the company is because we didn't get it right or we haven't gotten to it yet. Everything that's right on the team is because we brought in the right people, we've molded, we've enabled. And so you get this extraordinary sense of satisfaction and pride because you built it and now it's an entity that's providing opportunity for all these people that I work with now to do amazing things and they do it. And so I sort of take great satisfaction one step away that I was able to create that opportunity. Now they're making the most of it, but I was able to be a part of doing that. But it is different because you're dealing with a different demographic. I mean, our young people are just like young soldiers, but the relationship's still a bit different. You know, people call me Stan in the office and all that kind of thing. And, you know, millennials.
I hate to interrupt you, but I don't want to call you. I love that you want me to call you Stan, but I really feel a need to call you General. I'm calling you Stan. But do most people, is it hard for most people to just call you Stan?
I think they want to know whether I mean it when I say it. They want to know, did I say call me Stan, but I really mean you to call me General McChrystal or something else. I'm happy if they don't call me one of the many names I've been called in the past. So if they call me Stan or, you know, that's good. What I really want them to do is understand that there is a relationship that has to be built on me trusting them and them trusting me, even though we come at it from different generations and we come at it from different backgrounds. And, you know, I am a product of my background and my generation. And so there are barriers I've got to at least partially knock down, and I can help them knock them in the other direction. Because, you know, business is enough different that you can't go in. And one of the things in the military, you can hide behind your uniform and your rank. And in business, you can't. So what I've learned is the same is relationships and reputation. If you treat people right and you build a reputation for honesty and effectiveness, that's what sells the product. That's what keeps clients. You know, maybe there's smoke and mirrors in the short term, but in the long term, it's the opposite.
So you said reputation and relationship. This word reputation I find interesting, yeah. Particularly coming from you. There's all this bullshit in the business world today, Stan, about developing your personal brand. I'm sure you've heard some of this stuff. And there's all this stuff around your personal brand. And I can't disagree with that more. I'm a marketing guy. I get branding, right? But there's a big distinction between reputation and personal brand. And I find myself more and more aggravated when I hear personal brand. I say, look, the way to build a personal brand is to do legendary work, build a reputation for being undeniably legendary at what you do, and your quote-unquote personal brand will take care of it itself, right? So focus much more on being incredible at what you do, and that will build a reputation, and that will build a brand. And I feel like we've got it inverted. Am I crazy?
No, you've nailed it. And every time you deal with somebody, and we used to think about this in the military, don't focus on the operation you're doing. Focus on the next one. And so if you're dealing with somebody and you say, I want to do business with this person in the future, so how am I going to treat them now? That builds a part of your reputation, I think, is key. Because the most valuable thing to me is if someone says, I worked with Stan and I trust him.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I got to ask you, there's this thing in your new book where you say, leadership is not what you think it is, and it never was. And that sentence, I find the most fascinating part is the last piece, and it never was. So what do you mean by that?
Yeah, this most recent book was a fascinating journey for us, because what we decided to do is go back to first principles and look at leaders. And so we went back to Plutarch's lives. You know, he had profiled 48 leaders, Greeks and Romans, and we used that as a model, and we studied Plutarch's lives and what he was trying to show us. And what we essentially found was, throughout history, for a series of reasons, we have accepted the idea that the leader is, as we spoke earlier, the great woman or the great man. They have all the answers. And we look at historical happenings and we say, this happened because that great leader put their hands around history and turned it that way. And so we profile these 13 leaders, six pairs in genres like geniuses, Albert Einstein and Leonard Bernstein. reformers, Martin Luther and Martin Luther King Jr. And we look at them, and what we find is, in every case, this idea that we're going to keep the spotlight on the individual really downplays the context and the role of everyone else involved. You can call them followers, but they're actually just all the people they interact with. And so we found that nobody has ever been that great man or woman that we, I mean, they've been admirable people, but that great person who turns history. They've always been a part of the equation. And so we came out with this model that says that leadership is not this power that a leader focuses on followers and gets stuff done. Leadership is actually, we refer to it as an emergent property. You have this interaction between leaders and followers, and then all the contextual things that happen in the world, constantly changing. And leadership comes from that. It's an emergent property that can be positive, it can be negative, and it affects the situation. And the leader is rarely has, you know, dominance over that. They are just part of it. But we like the mythology because it's simpler. It's easier to get our heads around.
Yeah, and I'd be curious as to your reaction to this. I find the longer I've lived on the planet, the more I realize this. There's an interesting dichotomy here, which is on one hand, and you talk about it a lot, discipline, get up at 4 a.m., train, exercise, eat well, teach yourself, you know, get mentors, experiences, you know, become the man that you want yourself to be, right? So there is a lot of sort of self-discipline and self-application to achieve any level of success. There's no question about that. But the flip side that I find fascinating is other people make us successful.
Exactly. And I think those things, you know, if you do good things, you know, smart things, you can increase your likelihood of being successful or decrease it if you don't. But other people, and so it's the relationships ultimately that determine our, you know, success or failure. And so the idea that I'm going to be a great leader sort of regardless of everybody around me is ridiculous, because you're not a leader unless you're leading somebody and they're following.
Yeah. And so I just love that you kind of center on relationships and reputation. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I could talk to you, Stan, for 12 hours. We could do a mini series, which I'd be stoked about. But I also want to be respectful of your time. Is there anything else you want to touch on?
I think the one thing I'd say is, as we look at leadership, I want to go back to what you said about personal branding and whatnot. One of the things we studied in the book, as preparing the book, was the idea that the leader sort of creates this aura around themselves. And it's happened in the past. And I think right now in society, what we're doing is we're taking a more superficial look at leadership than we really ought to. We're looking at personal branding in one thing, and we're looking at very almost populist ideas. Find a populist idea and throw it out to people because that's the red meat that they want. And this happens on both sides. And that's not real long-term leadership. That's not building something over a lifetime or the life of a nation. And that's where I think we have to go back to first principles. We have to realize that we are all building a cathedral together, or we aren't. And if we're not, we better take a look in the mirror and decide what we got to do different.
We better get busy doing that, right? Because countries don't necessarily last forever, right?
None do.
Just like companies, yeah. All right, anything else before we wrap?
No, it's been my honor. Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have you back anytime. You can come back every other week if you like.
It's always a real pleasure.
Well, thank you. It's truly an honor, and good luck with the book launch. I'm sure it'll be another bestseller. I love that you're taking the time to write. You know, as somebody who myself now has written two books, I know how hard that is. And I know that you can't write the kinds of books that you're writing unless you're driven. Unless you're not writing it just because you don't want to sell books, right? No. It's so much more intellectually, emotionally, psychically. And so I also want to thank you for taking the time to really do what I know is a tremendous amount of work to continue to write, to share these learnings.
Well, you're kind, and I would offer the same back to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Stan. We'll talk soon, my friend.
Bye-bye.
You're legendary. Whew. Well, if you don't like that conversation, I guess I give up. Thank you again, Stan, for being on Legends and Losers. What an honor. If you know somebody who would love this episode as much as we do, why not share it with them right now? Your social media shares mean the world to me and to all of us at Legends and Losers and help fuel our growth. If you have 2 seconds, we'd also love an iTunes or anywhere else you experience Legends and Losers. We'd love it if you wrote us a review. Now, is it grow time for your business? See, it's not an accident that our founding sponsor is NetSuite, not some company that makes cat shampoo. One of the biggest challenges for any business is how do you scale, how do you grow, and how do you execute to really fulfill your potential? You need a platform for growth, and that's what NetSuite is. It's a platform in the cloud for virtually every aspect of your business, from how do you make sure that your website has all the right inventory, to managing your cash flow, to dealing with invoices, expenses, orders, and even HR. And NetSuite is also now part of Oracle, one of the largest technology companies on the planet. So the cool thing about this is when you as an entrepreneur, when you as a business leader use NetSuite as your platform, you are leveling the playing field with Fortune 500 companies because you have the power of one of the largest technology companies on the planet on your side. And now NetSuite is offering you an opportunity to get into what are the opportunities for growth in your business with a free 60-minute business review with an expert in your industry. So to get that set up, check out netsuite.com/legends. And while you're there, you'll be able to book a time for your 60-minute growth review, and we'll get you growing. All right. We would like to thank the new book by our friend and guest, General Stanley McChrystal, Leaders, Myth, and Reality. Our good friends at Atranet, Atre.net, is the company in Silicon Valley building corporate B2B websites that can represent your company like your best spokesperson. If you need a corporate B2B website, check out Atranet today. The number one best-selling new book by Heather Clancy and myself, Niche Down, How to Become Legendary by Being Different. Check it out on Amazon.com. Equity Directory. If you're in the startup ecosystem, you need to be on Equity Directory. This is where startup companies and people who work with startups come together and connect. OneLifeFullyLive.org. Dream, plan, and live your best life. We're the nonprofit trying to make a giant difference, starting off with helping you build a solid financial foundation and then build a great life on top of that. Check out OneLifeFullyLive.org. Speaking of growth, you want to grow yourself, you want to grow your business, check out growwire.com. This is what legendary entrepreneurs and business people are reading. Heather Clancy and I are contributors to GrowWire. We're having a great time working with these folks. We're putting up new blogs on a pretty regular basis. Check out growwire.com. Now, are you working long hours? Are you starting to feel a little whelmed, overly, that is to say? Maybe it's time for an assistant. Check out Bottleneck Virtual Assistants. This is a great way to get the help you need. Check out bottleneck.online today. And the amazing people at Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières. They are one of the few NGOs ever to win a Nobel Peace Prize, and they operate in some of the most challenging places on the planet, and they need your help. Make a donation today at doctorswithoutborders.org. All right, I need to remind you that this podcast is the sole property of the Legends and Losers Podcast Network, and we love it when you share the shit out of it. We must remind you that all rights do remain disturbed, and we have to warn you that this podcast is clearly produced in a studio that does contain nuts. Teach kids to serve their country in any way they want to or can. Remember, there's no such thing as a participation award. Aretha Franklin was right. Don't be lame. Get out of the passing lane. Call your mom and dad. Buy free-range, pasture-raised eggs. When in doubt, shred it out. Thank you, Dandy Candy. I love you, Mom and Dad. And hey, Colin, this oddcast really ties the room together, doesn't it? Today, our deepest apologies go to Marcus Rust, CEO of Rose Acre Farms. Sorry, Marky, we just ran out of time for you. That's it, my friends. Thank you so much for investing part of your life with us. And we look forward to seeing you again soon on Legends and Losers.